Passion for Thee is an excellent song for the life of John Mason Peck. And it's my privilege tonight to complete our brief overview of his life and ministry. My theme verse for tonight is from John chapter 4. And I believe John Peck was often inspired by the words, "Say not ye, there are yet 4 months, and then cometh harvest. Behold, I say unto you," Christ speaking to his disciples right outside Samaria, "lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they are white, all ready to harvest." If you can recall where we left off last night, let me just briefly set the stage. It's 1827. John Mason Peck is 36 years old. He got saved when he was 18, so he's been a believer now for as many years as he was an unbeliever. He and Sarah have been married for 18 years, and they've had six children so far. Their first son, Eli, passed away at age 10. Their son, William, passed away at age 3. But they have Hannah, Hervey, Marianne, William Stoughton, and little John, who's just 2 years old. He went west to St. Louis and the surrounding area with a burden to see the Western Baptists organized and advancing in the faith. And he has been pouring himself into it now for 9 years. He has lived a life of constant itinerating ministry, which means he would travel to communities, gather people together, and preach to them. If he won souls, he would try to organize them into a Baptist church. If there were already Baptists there, he would try to instruct them and try to get someone ready to exercise ministry in the community more effectively than what they had previously. He would start Sunday schools. Sometimes the Sunday schools would be connected to a church. Sometimes they would simply be standalone Sunday schools, and churches would later grow out of them. He would try to get mite societies started, where he would convince these small churches to give little offerings for missions. What would he do with those offerings? He would funnel them back to Philadelphia, and Philadelphia would take that money, aggregate it from all over the country, and send it to Adoniram Judson in Burma, or to other missionaries that they were now supporting around the world. The point he was making was that you believers ought to be concerned about evangelizing all over the globe. And it's real easy when you're a little community in a small place in the middle of nowhere to never lift your eyes up past your own cornfields. And he was teaching them to be thinking about world evangelization. He was trying to mobilize an army of Baptists. Part of that effort was education. And in addition to traveling around preaching, starting Sunday schools, giving away Bibles, selling Bibles, he also wanted to start a seminary. He had just recently moved with his family to Rock Spring, Illinois, just across the Mississippi River from St. Louis, and he donated a big chunk of his own homestead to start Rock Spring Theological and High School. It later changed its name to Rock Spring Seminary, and eventually it's going to be Shurtleff College. 1827, they opened that fall. They really became convinced when he got back. When we left off last time, you have to pretend like I'm still talking from last night. He had just made another survey trip of the East, and he had raised about 80% of the money that was necessary. That was enough money to start building buildings and hiring faculty. When he got back in the spring there of 1827, he donned his work clothes, and he and a bunch of workers went out into the forest and started cutting down trees and building buildings. And it reminds me of Brother Dion with his construction skills. Well, John Mason Peck's a classic pioneer. If you're going to be out in the rugged woods, you have to know more than, I mean, he knew how to read books and knew how to write books, but he also knew how to cut down trees and build buildings. And he started personally overseeing the construction of buildings for this work. He hired Joshua Bradley as principal. I don't know much about Joshua Bradley, but later on, Peck is actually going to write a biographical sketch of Bradley's life. He was deeply impressed by this man's spirituality. Then Peck himself became the first professor of theology. You say, well, I thought this was the guy that had a grammar school education. Yeah, well, by this time, men all over the region are willing to come and sit under his theological teachings. Why? Because he's been reading books and thinking deeply now for 18 years, and he is able to teach others. The first semester, almost, during the first semester, the school almost failed. And the reason was that they had built dormitories and men flocked to them. They had dozens of students when they opened in the fall. In fact, it surprised them how successful it was. But they had also hired someone to kind of oversee life in the dorms and to prepare the meals and to make sure these guys were taken care of. And that person was falling down on the job, something terrible. And Peck said, "We've got to get better help." And Bradley and the other men who were involved in setting up the school said, "Well, do you think Sarah could do it?" Well, this is his wife who's had health problems and who has six children. And they went to Sarah, and Peck said, "Well, she's in the other room. You can ask her." All right, Peck said, "I'm not asking her." And so they presented the need before her, and she said, "Yes, I suppose I could." All right, Peck said she wasn't enthusiastic. But as of January 1828, Sarah poured her enormous energies into organizing the schools and organizing the meal and helping with the laundry and making this thing work, in addition to managing her own household and running the post office. This was the first college in the state of Illinois. And it is celebrated as such at Southern Illinois University that eventually swallowed it up. Let me speak of the family just for a moment. I'm going to stretch the story out for a couple of years, but they're going to have three more children. An infant born December 10th, and we're told that the baby died before he or she was given a name, and therefore we don't know the sex of the baby, which is pretty unusual. But they lost their eighth child. And then they had, in 1829, a ninth child, Henry Martin. Now, the Martin is not spelled the same way, but I'm pretty sure this is named after the missionary Henry Martin, the great missionary to Persia. You remember some of his earlier sons were named after Hervey the preacher and William Stoughton the preacher and William Carey the missionary. This is kind of, the only exception was John Quincy Adams Peck, the president. And then James Ashford was born, 1727. This is their last child, their 10th child, and their seventh son. So if you're trying to keep up, I've summarized it for you. In 1832, the Pecks had five sons, ages 18, 9, 7, 3, and 1, and daughters, age 20 and 12. And some of those people are no doubt a big help. So some of them still require a lot of help. In 1844, so if we fast forward about 12 years, a visitor to the Peck household wrote a reminiscence of what he experienced there. And let me give you an excerpt of his reminiscence. It's interesting. I will resist the temptation to camp here. He said, "See his cheerful helpmate, contenting herself as best she may to abide at home, and assiduously care for the welfare of the family and guests, having never revisited her native New England since her first departure in 1817. Let me break. Later historians are going to nickname her Stay-at-Home Sally. Because, as we've noticed, year after year after year, Peck took 9 and 10 month trips to the East Coast. He's going to end up taking 6 of these trips over the years. When he wasn't traveling to the East Coast, he was itinerating across Missouri, Indiana, Illinois, occasionally into Iowa, occasionally over to Kentucky. You say, "Well, is this healthy?" It is what it is. Right? Peck had this incredible burden to be planting churches, and Sarah seems to have embraced her role as making sure that the household doesn't fall apart while he's gone. Quote, "Nor can you fail to notice that daughter Mary, with the father's energy and the mother's quietness, how steady, noiseless, and efficient are all her movements, and to her in no small degree are owing the comfort and happiness which always smile around that dwelling. We need say nothing of the sons, for the older ones were now absent, and of younger half-grown men it is not quite fair to speak, for they are not yet what they soon will be or ought to be, but as their good, considerate mother said, they do so much need their father with them. Still, we can truthfully testify to the kind-hearted ingenuousness which they uniformly evinced. May they one day prove their parents' crown of rejoicing. All I can tell you about the kids is that when the biographer wrote, all of them were in churches, leading decent lives, in Iowa, in good relationship with their dad. I can't tell you if they were ministers. I can't tell you if that they were all believers, although we have evidence of several of them coming to Christ. And I have no idea what happened to them subsequently. But to the degree that they were all serving God, God gets credit number one, and who gets credit number two? Yeah, Mama Sarah. In addition to everything else he was doing, about this time, a friend moved to Rock Spring who owned a printing press and set it up, and Peck said, "Great, I've been wanting to write more." And he launched a periodical called The Pioneer. He's going to publish The Pioneer for about 10 years. He's going to write most of the articles for it, and it is going to be a well-read periodical that spreads all across the region. First issued in 1829, and it's going to run for about 10 years. Finally, in 1839, as we'll see a little later, he's going to back out of this venture, which took a lot of time and effort. But he wasn't done publishing. Let me just mention some of his other writings. He started a monthly journal a year or two later. The Pioneer was aimed at all Christians. It was a very, say, Catholic periodical, Catholic in the sense of he wanted to reach all the denominations. Then he started a periodical once a month that was targeted for Baptists. He also started a half sheet that advanced Sunday schools. He continued to update all his life his guide for emigrants that sold really well in the East and helped supplement his income. He produced with a friend. He had a friend who was very good at map making, but the map maker, he wasn't good at putting books together. So Peck connected with this guy who was a topographer, and they produced a gazetteer, or what we would call an Atlas of Illinois, which became the best Atlas of Illinois on the market. They're going to continue to update this atlas for the rest of Peck's life. And by the way, as Peck traveled around Illinois gathering data, he would put it into the atlas and say, "Hey, we don't have that river quite right," etc. He wrote an expose of Mormonism in 1835. John Smith and company had just recently arrived and were causing all kinds of trouble in Illinois, and Peck went after them. He wrote a biography of Daniel Boone. A Kentuckian was producing an American biography dictionary with articles, substantial articles. This ran to about 100 pages. And Peck wrote a biographer of Daniel Boone. He wrote a multi-volume history of the settlement of Illinois. These volumes came out one by one over the last 10 or 12 years of his life and are an invaluable resource on how Illinois was originally settled. And then he was constantly writing articles, and all I can say is that I don't know how he did this. That is, you know, I write about an article a year, and I'm very proud of myself that I manage my 1,200 words. Shortly thereafter, in 1831, his friend Jonathan Going, that we mentioned last night, traveled to Rock Spring and met with Peck and said, "We need to organize the Western Department no longer as a Ministry of the Massachusetts Society, but we need a national organization backing up what you're doing." And Peck said, "Amen. That sounds great." And so he and Going took a survey trip, and it took several months, and they traveled across Missouri, Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky. And in 1832, they established, Going with as the first president, the American Baptist Home Mission Society. So at this point, there are now three societies in Baptist life. There is the Triennial Convention that meets every 3 years and supports foreign missions. There is a publication society that is rooted in Philadelphia and publishes Bibles and tracts and religious literature. And now there is a home mission society that will run for the next 80 years supporting missions to the West, because there's a whole lot of continent that we need to evangelize. And surprise, surprise, they appointed John Mason Peck as the director of the Western Mission. All right, so he is now engaged in this work. But during these years, as Peck and Going are traveling all over the Midwest, analyzing the churches, the Sunday schools, putting together a plan to present in the East for a home mission society, war breaks out. The Black Hawk War. There's a Wikipedia picture of Chief Black Hawk. This was a brutal war in which some Indians, it looks a little bit like a misunderstanding over property rights, but it ended up being very bloody. And some Indians decided they would strike across the Mississippi and wreak havoc, and the retaliation by the army was very strong. And for Peck, this meant travel was even more dangerous. It was always dangerous, but he's not going to stop itinerating because war is going on. In fact, He regards this as opportunity to minister to families in harm's way. And he sets out to make sure these villages hear the gospel before they're attacked by these Indians. He also published support for the war effort. That's not too surprising. What is significant, I believe, is that he also wrote several articles. And these articles showed the independence of mind Peck had, and I think a little bit of his heart. He said, Indians are being retaliated against up and down the region, whether they're revolting or not. People are so afraid that they're beginning to attack our Indian friends, even though they're not part of the revolt. And they're treating these people like they're savages without souls. And he said, we need to not forget to be concerned about the Indian spiritual welfare. A lot of Westerners said they're simply in our way. Let's kill them or let's ship them out, but let's get them out of our way. And Peck said, these are eternal souls that we need to be burdened for. And I like the fact that on the one hand, he says, listen, I'm as patriotic as the next guy, and I don't believe we should defend ourselves from this attack. On the other hand, our primary priority should be peace so that we can evangelize. Well, the war finally ended, and he was able to devote himself to the seminary. And I give you here a little bit of information about it. The seminary was not doing as well at Rock Spring as Going thought it could be. And Going said, why don't we find a more centrally located, better spot closer to a river where it can be accessed by people more readily? And they canvassed a number of places and decided on Upper Alton, Illinois, just, you know, in the bend of the Mississippi, just above the bend. And they built seminary buildings there. And this was the first Baptist college west of the Appalachians. And it moved there in 1834. By 1836, all of Shurtleff's money had arrived, and they renamed the school Shurtleff College. Shurtleff College is going to continue to train ministers for the gospel for over 100 years. It is finally going to run out of useful life in the 1950s, and in 1957, it will close its doors, and the property will be purchased by Southern Illinois University. And today, the buildings are used as a dental program, a dental school, which is under the auspices of SIU. But Shurtleff College was a dynamic Baptist institution for long after Peck passed away. And let me just give you a quote about what the seminary meant to Peck. The affairs of the seminary, this is Babcock, the biographer. The affairs of the seminary, a charter of it as a college was about this time obtained, caused him very frequent visits to its locality at Upper Alton. Remember, he lived in Rock Spring, which was about 30 miles from Upper Alton. To secure in an economical and efficient manner the requisite buildings, to harmonize teachers young and old from New England and from Old England, as well as some raised up on the ground, which is interesting, to watch over and procure in tolerable season the scanty finances derived chiefly from small subscriptions, and to give as much efficiency and reputation as possible to the young and unendowed institution, required of him, with all his other cares and toils, much more of effort than he was really able to put forth. That's the last I'll say about it, but that's going to be a burden on his heart for the rest of his life. For the next 20-some years, in addition to everything else he's going to do, he's going to be concerned about the seminary. But that brings us to the next part of our outline. Y'all with me? 1835 to 1845, slowing down. Ages 46 to 50, you get to your mid-40s, you need to slow down, right? He had health issues. He struggled with recurring illnesses. He talks about how his digestion wasn't good. Remember those corn pone meals he was talking about? Well, they'll get to you eventually. He had chills and fevers periodically. He had struggles that are typical of pioneer life. And in 1836, he decided, I've got to slow down. I can't keep up this pace. So he resigned as superintendent of the Western branch of the Sunday School Union. He had been running that job for about 10 years. He began to cut back his writing ministry. In a few years, he's going to unload his periodical altogether. And he said, I'm just going to devote myself to the seminary and to preaching in the local area. There's plenty to be done here. And God blessed. In this part of his journal, he talks about how the Lord was blessing greatly. He says several of his sons were saved. Based on what I could tell, this is probably Hervey and John who were saved at this time. He said, after the Black Hawk War, there are a number of people who were softer towards the gospel. Fear will do that. And he said, scarce a sermon have I delivered of late which God has not blessed in the conversion of souls. So he went off on another tour. Went into Western Illinois. For the first time, he crossed over into Iowa. And he said, every pioneer community I came to had survived the war, and they were open to the gospel, and it just got him excited. So he went over into Illinois, and he helped helped organize the Illinois Education Society. He became more involved in the Illinois Baptist Association annual meetings. What this indicates is that by the mid-1820s, Daniel Parker and company and the anti-missionary folk had turned most of the Illinois associations against missions. But in the intervening 10 years, Peck and others have been busily preaching and sharing the gospel and seeing souls saved, and the tide is turning. That is, the anti-missionary people are beginning to lose. He also began to devote himself more to pastoring. Rock Spring and Zoar were two towns in close proximity, and their church needed a pastor, and Peck agreed to sort of be their pastor as often as he could be there. That is, he was sort of halfway between their pastor and their stated supply. And in Rock Spring, revival came in 1839, 22 conversions, including his son, William Stoughton. So far his slowing down hasn't been as slow as he maybe thought. And then something happens which kind of lightens the heart. Sarah agreed to go on a tour with him. So he and his wife, I mean, they've got some older kids now that can look after the younger kids. He and Sarah decide to go on a trip. This is a trip in which they went up into Indiana where a lot of her relatives were. And they visited with a number of her family members. They did their first visit to Chicago. She never went on another trip with him, and something he writes in his journal may explain it. The whole journey above indicated was accomplished not without the usual accompaniment of such tours. Sundry breakdowns, that is of their wagon, the loss of the right way in the woods and on the prairies, especially many thorough wettings in the rains, which were more than usually abundant for this season of the year. And Sarah thoroughly enjoyed the trip and said, never again. And when he got back from that trip, he said, I've really got to slow down this time. All right, I've really got to slow down this time. I mean, come on now, I'm 40 years old. After much serious reflection, I have come to the conclusion that I must give up traveling and all missionary agency. I have now made trials for four seasons, 36, 37, 38, 39, and cannot sustain the fatigue, labor, and exposure. My liver is permanently affected. My constitution seriously impaired, and I must retire to a more quiet and sedentary life. There is field enough for me to occupy around me, and divine providence will in some way provide for me. All right, there's the plan. So he gave up most of his ministries. He sold his periodical. He settled down to local church life. And he discovered that pastoring that union churches wasn't enough, so he picked up a pastorate in nearby Belleville. So slowing down meant taking on another local church pastorate. And then his old friend Going said, you know, we're having a meeting of the Western Baptist Convention in Louisville. Could you come? So he went, 1840. Jonathan Going was president. Now these conventions would meet for 4, 5, 6, 7 days, and you have a president over the convention. You would appoint a secretary who would run the affairs all year long, and then they'd elect a president for the convention. That's usually the way these practice. So they asked Peck to be the chair of the steering committee for Western missions. Then he was asked to be the secretary of the Western Historical Society. He agreed to do that. And then they asked him if he would be willing to revise the Western hymnal, because it wasn't very good. So he spent a number of months revising the hymnal and improving it. He ended up spending about 4 weeks in Louisville and agreeing to return for a while every year. And later that year, in fact, the next year, he was appointed General Secretary of the Western Baptist Association. Quote, various indications of providence in opening my way and removing difficulties seem to point out the pathway of duty in this direction. Whether I can endure the exposure and fatigue necessarily involved and sustain health is to be tested by experience. All right, so I'm going to try to do this and see if I collapse. My hopes are that by steamboat and stage traveling, By spending the winters south and the summers north, and having comfortable houses to lodge in, I may keep up a few years longer. This certainly is the greatest and most responsible business I have ever undertaken. May the good one direct and keep me and allow me to fill up the balance of my life with usefulness. That's his motto. So he resigns his pastorates. He was able to find replacements in both of his pastorates. He moves to Louisville. Why? Because Louisville is the headquarters for the Western Baptist Association. Sarah can't go. I mean, she's got to run the homestead. She's still got a bunch of kids at home. Besides, she's the postmaster. So he comes up with a schedule in which he'll live in Louisville for part of the year and then make sure he's home in Rock Spring, Christmas time and during the bad months. A little later that month, in fact, a month later, he is elected president of the Illinois Baptist Convention, which was a major defeat for the anti-missions people. But now that he is working for the WBA, he's going to need to travel east and rally support. So he does his third trip east in 1842 from April to November. I could spend a lot of time on this trip. A lot of interesting things happen. I cut it down to just a couple. He got to hear William Miller preach. Now, who is William Miller? He's the guy who in 1842 predicted that Jesus was coming back. In fact, he said exactly what day he was coming back. And Peck heard him preach. And Miller preached on the return of Christ in a few months. And it being Peck, he went up and talked to Miller after the service and said, "Sir, I really appreciate your heart, but have you considered," and he proceeded to demolish his argument. And then he wrote in his journal, "Mr. Miller is like a lot of people who focus on one issue. They're very unteachable." he was really not able to be budged from his position. Miller, of course, revised his prediction after the Lord didn't come back to later in 1843. And then after 1843, the Lord didn't come back. He said, "Oh, my bad," and went back to being a Baptist pastor. While visiting New England, Peck heard William Lloyd Garrison give an anti-slavery speech. Now, I pointed out last night how strongly anti-slavery Peck was. But he was outraged by William Lloyd Garrison because Garrison was an ends justifies the means guy. That whatever it takes to get rid of slavery, we should do it. Whether that's revolt or rebellion or whatever it takes. And Peck proceeded to write an article in which he called him an ultraist. One of these people that just is over the top. And he said, "Listen, I'm as opposed to slavery as he is, but there are Christian ways to do this." And then he discovered the temperance movement. And temperance crusades were being held across New York and Boston. And he loved that and jumped in and participated in the temperance crusades. The highlight of the trip for him, he also attended the annual meetings of the Sunday School Society and the Temperance Society and all the societies. But the highlight was going back to the church in which he was baptized and preaching from that pulpit. It was a wonderful trip. On his way home, he decided to swing south and visit Tennessee, which he had never visited. And he went to Nashville. And here's what he said about it. "Today I attended for a few moments a sale in the marketplace. A Negro boy was sold, who appeared about 12 years old. He stood by the auctioneer on the market bench with his hat off, crying and sobbing, his countenance a picture of woe. I know not the circumstances, but it was the first human being I ever saw set up for sale, and it filled me with indescribable emotions. Slavery in its best state is a violation of man's nature and of the Christian law of love." Well, he got back from that trip in November. And then he realized that if the Western Association is really going to be successful, it needs to include believers in the Southwest. So he took a tour south to open 1843. And a couple of highlights of this tour, in which he saw a lot of slavery, it outraged him. But he went to the Hermitage, where retired President Andrew Jackson was. And he met with Jackson and had a lengthy conversation with him, was extremely impressed. When he got back to St. Louis, the timing was really good because Charles Dickens was touring the city at that time, and he got to meet Charles Dickens. And this is one of my favorite lines in Peck's journal, where Peck says, "I met Charles Dickens, the noted author, and I gave him two of my books." So he did not lack for confidence. After settling in at home, after these repeated trips, he received a letter from the East in which he was asked if he would be willing to become the new secretary of the Babelish Publication Society. Major responsibility, it was one of the three major Northern Baptist societies. A Westerner had never headed up these societies. And Peck said, I'm willing, but there are some conditions. This was a struggling organization. The previous leadership had not been successful. The organization was almost bankrupt. He said, I will not come unless there is a cross-the-board 25% reduce of all salaries, including mine. Furthermore, I want absolute right to make any changes I need to make. And they said, come on. And he headed east in March of 1843. He'd been home for less than a month. This is his fourth trip east. He arrives in Philadelphia and stays there from May 43 to January 44. Why? Because he's got to completely reorganize this society. Here's this Western guy who's been riding around on a horse through muddy streams visiting settlements, who is now in Philadelphia, one of the largest cities in America, and he shows organizational genius. I mean, he just completely shakes the thing up. He launches a plan for reading and literacy advocacy across the country. He starts preaching a series of sermons on give attention to reading. And while there, he meets an old friend, Lyman Beecher, who by now is one of a famous people. He meets John Leland, the great Baptist preacher who is going to pass away in just a few years, and he interacts with Francis Whalen, the president of Brown, who wrote the first biography of Adoniram Judson. It's a memorable trip. Quote, from May to December, he preached 78 times, delivered 30 other addresses, visited 45 churches officially, 4 associations, 5 state conventions, 6 ministers' meetings, 1 camp meeting, and 1 college commencement, and traveled 3,310 miles besides office work enough to have fully engrossed an ordinary man. Such were his common experiences and efforts for the whole period of his official connection with the society, varied and somewhat relieved by his annual visit to home, to Sarah. Hey, Sarah, I'm back. Enjoy it. At the end of his fourth trip east, he returned home. This ended up being a very, very memorable trip. He would normally catch a steamship at Pittsburgh and take it all the way down to home. But on this occasion, things went poorly. And what I'm about to do, I have never done in a PowerPoint presentation. I'm going to read you his account. It's a little bit long, but if you stay with me, you will remember this after you forget everything else I said. Here is Peck's account of what happened to him. Retired to my berth at about 9:30 with my clothes on except my coat, the night being very cold. This is January 1843. After considerable time, I fell asleep. Near 11 o'clock, I was awakened by a dreadful crash. The boat struck a large snag, scarcely above the surface of the water. This occurred a little below the mouth of Cahokia Creek. I heard nearly at the same instant screams of distress and sprang from my berth, put on my coat, seized one boot, but before I could put it on, the water was rushing into my stateroom, which was forward of the wheelhouse. Without boots or hat, I rushed onto the guard, seized the projecting portion of the hurricane or upper deck, where after considerable difficulty I succeeded in getting onto that deck. A number of persons were already there, and many more got on from the stern afterward. The bow was so far under water as to cover the guards, but the stern held up some time longer. Hearing cries in the ladies' cabin, I got the pole of a wagon on the deck, and thrusting it in at the skylight, tried to pry off the roof, but found it impossible. The ladies, however, succeeded in getting on the hurricane deck, as did most of the steerage passengers. The boat was then floating sideways down the current, and soon ran on another snag and careened partly over. This threw off the boilers, and the bow, thus lightened, brought the guards to the surface. The hull of the boat then separated and floated alongside the cabin and upper works. Next, the smokestacks, or chimneys, fell, which tore off the end of the hurricane deck. Captain Howell, with several other persons, was killed or knocked overboard by the fall of the chimneys. The wheelhouses were soon separated from the deck and floated off or sunk. Finding myself exposed to the piercing atmosphere, I got down on the guards, but before this, I had prayed repeatedly with the people around me. At first, there was much confusion and many screams and howlings to God for mercy. Some professors of religion prayed consistently. While I was on the guard and the hull of the boat was floating alongside, I got on the bow and stood for some minutes, but not liking its movements, I was induced to return to the guard again. Soon, the hull struck a bluff bar and turned nearly over. Several were on it and were drowned. Persons now gathered planks, doors, and pieces of the wreck to swim on. I looked about for something of the kind, but finally concluded to stick by the wreck while it floated. The hurricane deck fell off after a while, caused, I suppose, by the weight of the people upon it. We were now on a sort of raft formed by the cabin floor and guards, which continued floating as the current bore us, first on one side, then in the middle, and then on the other side of the river. Some were entirely wet, men, women, and children with very little clothing on. They suffered intensely. A steamer lay at the shot tower just above Vidaposhi. I don't know how to pronounce that. Vidaposhi? And as we passed near, we aroused the men on board who came off in their yawl. As it neared the wreck, I directed them to pass around to the stern and first relieve the women and children who were perishing. They took on board their boat most of the ladies and children and put them on shore. The next time the yawl came near the stern on my side, I had made up my mind, since I did not suffer severely as some others, to give them the preference. But seeing a little girl quite helpless, I caught her up and leaped under the boat. By this time, we had floated a long distance down the current and were landed a full mile below the city, so that I had to walk without boots or shoes. My stockings were soon worn through. The ground was frozen hard, and its sharpness hurt me at every step. One foot was frozen about the ball and very much cut. I carried, too, one of the babes of Mrs. Snell, a passenger. On reaching the first house, they would not let us in. At the next, we obtained shelter and refreshment. Soon after, a little girl was brought in by some men, entirely cold, speechless, senseless. I got a blanket, removed her wet and frozen garments, and rubbed her with flannels and vinegar. It was about an hour before she began to moan, and more than 4 hours before any warmth appeared except about the heart. She so far recovered before I left the place as to speak, and the narrator adds that her name was Maria Poole, and Peck received acknowledgement from her parents later. A boy was brought in alive, and I prescribed the same course for him, but he was suffered to die. Another girl was brought in dead. The yawl went 4 times to the wreck, and the ferryboat Icelander helped to complete the work. Soon as daylight dawned, I went to the store and bought a cap and shoes. Went also to the wreck in a steam tug sent down by the mayor of St. Louis, found my large trunk with manuscripts and other materials with overcoat, so that the pecuniary loss was but about $30. At an early period, and when the boat was breaking up, I fully expected death, as I could not swim, but felt calm and resigned, no ecstasy and no fear, but perfect self-possession with ability to think of and care and pray for others. Eternity will never seem nearer till I enter it. Oh, that's kind of exciting. What he says next is that even though I was lame in one foot, I took carriage as rapidly as I could to Rock Spring because I wanted to get there before Sarah and the kids found out about the wreck. And he was able to get there before they received news and assure them that he was okay. Letters flooded in from all over the country from friends expressing their condolences that he went through it and their thanks that he survived. Now, if it were I would say, okay, I'm done with steamships. In fact, I think I'm done with traveling. Slowing down for sure this time. Peck said, "Blessed be God for his goodness to me. I consider myself under additional obligation anew to devote myself unreservedly to his service." He's going to spend about 10 weeks home recovering. And then you know what he's going to do? He's going to jump on a steamship and head back to Philadelphia because he's still the head of the Publication Society. And he got there in April 1844, launched his sermon series on reading, and he began editing and publishing classic works, Alexander Carson's work on baptism, the best book on baptism ever written, the combined works of Andrew Fuller that we discussed last year, and some of the works of the great British Baptist theologian Abraham Booth. And then he returned home. The following year, he needed to go east for the last time. 1845, he went on behalf of the Publication Society and because he wanted to make the triennial convention meeting that year. That year, the Southern Baptists put forward a trial candidate for missions who was a slave owner. And the missions committee rejected him. And the Southern Baptists said, "Aha! We knew you were rejecting slave owners." And as a group, they withdrew from the triennial convention and voted into existence the Southern Baptist Convention. By the way, in 1996, the Southern Baptists issued a formal apology to the African-American community for doing that. So the SBC was established. A consequence that I had never really thought about was that the SBC, the Southern Churches, accounted for nearly a third of the budget of all of the societies. And suddenly their budgets were deeply impacted, and Peck was desperate for income. So he traveled all over the place trying to raise money. He traveled up in New England, visited Maine for the first time. And then he went south. And he said in his journal, you know, these brethren in Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, they're very cordial, but they said, we're not supporting anything but our own stuff from now on. And then he attended the final meeting of the Triennial Convention. They changed the name to the American Baptist Missionary Union. And when they wrote the new constitution, they formed a committee to write it, and Peck was appointed to that committee. But maybe the highlight of that convention was meeting Adoniram Judson, who was home from his only furlough. And I would like to have a transcript of their conversation, but I don't think it exists. But that would be cool. Well, when he went home from that, at the end of that meeting, he announced his resignation as secretary of the Publication Society. He says, I've done what I can, and it's universally agreed that his changes enabled that society to survive and thrive and later on become Judson Press, which nowadays publishes almost nothing worth reading, unfortunately. Let us close our story. Final Ministries, ages 56 to 68. Because if you weren't following along, he's now in his mid-50s. He resolved to slow down 10 years ago. He didn't slow down much. But now he's going to settle down. In the late 1840s, he focuses on local work. He became part-time pastor or supply for churches in Troy, Edwardsville, Belleville, and Bethel, in addition to Rock Lake, Zoar, and Belleville. Oh, Belleville's already listed there. And then the church in St. Louis, the mother church, lost its pastor. And for 9 months, he was the interim pastor in St. Louis. He held the church there until Jeremiah Jeter arrived. Jeremiah Jeter is going to be one of the great Southern Baptist pastors. And Jeter succeeded him as pastor there in St. Louis. And later that year, he was invited by a small church outside Louisville to come be their pastor, and he agreed to do it. And he went there and was pastor for 3 years, 1849 to 1852. During these years, several severe trials came. In 1852, Shirtliff College, most of it, burned to the ground. He housed his personal library there for the use of the students. We're told it was the largest library west of the Mississippi, and the whole library was lost to fire. And then that is a tragedy. So I got to raise money. So he's going to head east to raise money. He didn't go far. He stopped in Louisville and presented a plan for a Baptist Historical Society, a plan that was adopted. He received an honorary doctorate from Harvard University, 1852. So this grammar school education Peck was now Dr. Peck, although he never let anybody call him that. And then in 1853, a little church near Cincinnati asked him to be their pastor. So he accepted the job, even though Sarah stayed back in Rock Spring. But after 3.5 months, his health was such that he had to resign, and it was no longer possible for him to be away from home. His doctor said, Peck, this time, you really have to slow down. And he did. He settled into local work. And then he got word in 1856 that his son, Hervey, passed away at age 41. So he had outlived three of his kids. And then a couple years, just later that year, November of that year, his beloved Sarah passed away. In the spring, he published two articles called A Model Wife and Mother, a tribute to Sarah. And here's what he says. This was not a normal husband-wife relationship. But here's what he said. The wife I have loved was an extraordinary wife and mother, and I think in justice to her memory, as an illustration of my poor labors, I ought to devote one reminiscence to her. As a remarkable helpmate in all my labors and efforts, I have never thought it expedient and proper to write or speak in praise of my late dear wife while living. But now she has finished her course. It ought to be known in what sense and to what extent she was the helpmate preeminently in every department of labor her husband undertook. I now assure all my friends that had not that woman possessed the principles and been the wise, prudent, self-denying head, he put head in caps, not me. That's emphasis in the original. The wise, prudent, self-denying head and government of my family, she was. I could not have made half the sacrifices and performed half the services my kind friends have attributed to me. And to that, I'm inclined to say, amen. Amen. That is surely true. One more trip, but it's not east. He wants to go see all his kids. July to September 1857, traveled up the Mississippi to Galena, which was as big as Chicago at the time, visited his children, his grandchildren, most of them were in Iowa, entered Wisconsin, visited Madison, and then he visited Chicago and was hosted by the mayor of the city, sailed back to Galena, and then home to Rock Spring, and he didn't have long to live. So his final trip. His health began to fail in early 1858, and on March 14th, 1858, Peck passed away on a Sunday. He was 68 years old. And he was buried initially in Rock Spring, and then they moved his body to St. Louis and built quite a nice grave for him. Let me quote Jeremiah Jeter on his character, draw some lessons, and I'm done. Here's what Jeter said about Peck. Though he was a man of strong will and loved as earnest and energetic men are apt to do to have his own way, yet I never discovered in him the signs of envy or of mortified ambition. He thought, of course, his own plans right and struggled manfully to carry them out, but accorded to brethren differing from him sincerity and worthy motives. In all his plans for extending the kingdom of Christ, and they were numerous, and in all his warm controversies in supporting them, there was an almost perfect self-abnegation. Have you ever known somebody who's very strong-willed, but then you find out it's not because it's about them? I used to work for a guy who really knew his mind, and he knew how to say, this is what we ought to do, do it. And yet, the more you got to know him, the more you found out that, you know what, he's the humblest person in the room, because it's not about him, it's about the task. And he loved people as they were doing it. He goes on to say, Mr. Peck was a Western man. He removed to the West while young, and his taste, manners, habits, and modes of thinking and speaking were formed there. No intelligent and observant man could be in his presence 5 minutes without perceiving unmistakable evidence of this truth. The pioneers were a hardy, self-denying, courageous, and independent class of men. For forms, etiquette, and pretensions, they had no respect. They were practical, not theoretic. Mr. Peck was not only a pioneer, but a master spirit among the pioneers. Perhaps no man of the class did more than he to guide the thoughts, mold the manners, and form the institutions of the West. He was an embodiment of Western character, plain, frank, self-reliant, fearless, indomitable, with all his powers, physical and intellectual, subordinated by grace to the service of Christ. When I read that, I said, yeah, that seems about right. And of course, Jeter knew him really well. Three lessons from the life of John Mason Peck, and I think you could come up with them before I give them to you. Number one, let's just quote Jim Elliot. Only one life will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. Well, that was said in the 20th century, but it describes Peck pretty well in the 19th. He lived with urgency. Secondly, Christian ministry always involves teamwork. He could not have done what he did without a self-sacrificing wife. And third, his labors were not in vain in the Lord. There are churches all over this region, some of which you will see tomorrow night, that were founded by John Mason Peck. That is, he wasn't a flash in the pan. He laid foundations that people could build on for generations. So praise the Lord that this region of the country was impacted by the man with 20 hands. Pastor.